You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. If tonight's movie night is just what you need, make it special with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Warning, this podcast contains spoilers for Season 3, Episode 7 of The Mandalorian and the movie Renfield, out now in theaters. Hello, my name is Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Rosie Knight.
And welcome to X-Ray Vision, the crooked media podcast, where we dive deep into your favorite shows, movies, comics, and pop culture.
In this episode, it's a packed previously on with some of the Star Wars Celebration news. Boom, 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 movies, TV, everything. And a breakdown of the Marvels trailer. In the airlock, it's Season 3, Episode 7 of The Mandalorian, in case you haven't been Star Wars'd out. Wars Celebration. It's happening. In the hive mind, just absolutely delightful chat with actor and comedian Ben Schwartz to discuss Renfield, starring Nicholas Hoult and Nick Cage.
A delightful movie.
Dracula. Actually very delightful and quite profound in some ways. Yeah. And in Nerd Out, we have a theory from Mike on The Mandalorian.
Let's go. Coming up, previously on. First up, let's talk about some of the big news coming out of Star Wars Celebration.
Big.
And I think the headline, for me at least, is going back to the movies. Three big movie project announcements. No titles as yet, but the attached directors and then kind of what the movie is about were announced. We have a James Mangold project that will talk about basically the first Jedi, the first connection with the Force, the dawn of the Jedi. We have Dave Filoni's project, which will wrap up all of his New Republic projects in a live action film. This is, I guess, our chance to see Grogu and Din and the rest on the big screen. And then Ms. Marvel director Charmaine Obaid-Chinoy will direct the sequel to the Rey saga. Rey is coming back. We would assume Finn is coming back as well. We're going to find out what she's been up to. And what she's been up to is training the next generation of Jedi. Does that mean we find out that Finn is Force sensitive? I say yes.
Now, correct. I mean, he is. Let's be real. They better bring John Boyega back or there's going to be a problem.
These all sound really great. We were talking in the pre-pro. What of these three, how many get made?
Okay, I am of the belief, looking at recent past and the success of announced Lucasfilm movies making it to screen, my gut says I would bet that one of these 100% makes it to screen, and I think it's the Rey movie.
I agree.
Which I agree with you. I hope is a Rey and Finn and Poe movie. You know, that's the trio that I care about. I think that the Filoni movie is second most likely.
Agreed.
Because people love The Mandalorian. Grogu is very toyetic. You can make a lot of money from selling toys from him. And Rebels has gained a real hearty following.
Yeah.
And with Ahsoka coming, I think that one seems quite likely. I just, the slight doubt I have is, how likely is it for us to see something in the Star Wars world make that big leap from TV to film rather than film to TV? I would love to see it, but I think it's quite ambitious. Least likely, but the one I would want to see most, is this like biblical epic 25,000 years before the Star Wars Skywalker saga, James Mangold, like beginning of the Force. I just think it's too huge. It's too huge. I would love, like, do I want to see like a, you know, Lawrence of Arabia style Star Wars movie? Absolutely, yes.
Absolutely.
Is it likely? Probably not. That's my feeling.
Right there with you. I think your read is exactly right. I put the Filoni movie at something like a coin flip. Obviously, this is not science, but you know, depending on how the reception for Mando and for Ahsoka goes, I could see them flipping that cachet into a big movie project. That would be pretty cool. And I think, but I agree with you. It feels like just too huge a swing for what has been, I think, a historically conservative movie project space for Star Wars. Like, maybe they've changed their tune, but what we've seen from the last few Star Wars movies, not counting Rogue One, has been a real kind of aversion to kind of breaking the mold or doing anything big. And this would be, this is as big as it gets.
I mean, you're talking about setting a movie like 21,000 years before Knights of the Old Republic. Like, this is so much further back than anything that we've ever seen. It's such a cool idea, but what we've seen from the Star Wars TV shows, especially, I feel like, less so in the movies, though I wish they'd have done it more, we've seen them taking very selectively from established pre-Disney canon-like legends and making it canon again in the Disney world. This would be James Mangold, who I love. I mean, Logan, he's obviously in with Disney. He's doing this Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny film. You know, this would be basically giving him carte blanche to create an entirely new era of Star Wars, which I think is very exciting, but slightly unlikely, unless perhaps we end up in a kind of High Republic-esque situation where they use a new set of authors and books and comics to kind of establish the era.
To lay the groundwork. Yeah, that, because I could see that, that happening.
That could maybe happen because basically one of the, as we'll get into in a little bit with the TV stuff, we are now seeing them start to pull from the High Republic, which they established in those books. So maybe, but I definitely think that's our... that's our long shot, even though I would absolutely love to see it.
Also, the risk, I think, is it's hard to kind of overstate, I think, the risk. Recall the uproar when midichlorians appeared on the scene.
Yes.
As a, you know, the first kind of real fleshing out of the underpinnings of the Force. And people didn't like it. And I, and, you know, the Force is this kind of like mysterious... connective tissue that runs through the galaxy and the universe. There's something fascinating and intriguing about the mystery behind it. And so
yeah,
obviously
it's very enigmatic and ethereal and
And so to really kind of pin it down and define it in this way is high risk, high reward. I would love, I would fucking love to see it. But my guess is that they pull back from actually doing this.
Also, does, hypothetically, if this is, they're saying biblical epic, you're talking about the first person to ever use the Force. Is this like a Jesus situation? Is this like an actual space Jesus? Like the first person to use the Force gains a following? Are we going to see the, I think the, it's so much fun to imagine it because it is so huge. But like you say, what does that do to the thousands of years of canon that comes after it? Like, when do you, what are these two alignments? When does it split between the dark side and the light side? Do you have to bring back Grey Jedi, which have been decanonized in a very serious way? I think it's so huge, but it's very exciting to imagine it. And I would love, if the movie doesn't get made, I'll definitely be seeking out that script.
Absolutely.
And, in years to come.
And what I think is really, the other thing that I think is really, really cool about these announced projects is you've basically gone to the very beginning and the very end. You've pushed out the latest that we've ever gone in Star Wars. We're going, the Rey project is going to be, according to Kathleen Kennedy, 15 years out from Rise of Skywalker. Post-war, post-First Order, she says, and the Jedi are in disarray. So that's as late as we've been in Star Wars, the furthest out. And then the furthest back, if they end up making this movie that we've ever seen in the Star Wars universe, would be this 25,000 years before the Skywalker saga, before the First Republic, before all of everything we know. So that part of it is really intriguing to kind of push the edges of the timeline out as far as it's ever been. That part of it is cool. Up next, the Ahsoka trailer. I'm in.
I mean, come great. On. I mean, we were deeply targeted by this. Let's be real. Yeah. Like,
it looks fantastic. Rebels. The casting looks amazing. The, you know, building off what we've seen from Andor, from The Mandalorian, it looks movie quality. The trailer looks, you know, the practical effects plus the makeup look amazing. I was so chuffed to see my Star Wars wife, Hera Syndulla, and our good friend Chopper, one of the greatest mass murderers in Star Wars history.
Yeah,
for
it's
Sabine,
just so great.
Ezra, it looks freaking great. There's a Lothcat there. It looks great.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, multiple Lothcats. Love to see them. Also, I think that they're having a lot of fun in this trailer, not only showing us who's coming back, but also like only showing Ezra via a hologram. So you kind of don't really know. But the fact that we are confirmed now to get live action Thrawn, which is huge. And obviously, for the first time, this is doing what we always wanted. When they would announce something for the MCU, we would expect that the TV shows would immediately tie in. That never really came across. Like Spider-Man at the end of Hawkeye and those kind of things that people wondered if they were going to do to tie these worlds together. We get the Lars Mikkelsen announcement. He's going to be coming back. He's going to be playing Thrawn in live action. We see the back of his head in this trailer. And then, as we will get into, this episode of The Mandalorian immediately ties into that. You know, this is that kind of connective tissue we always wanted. And with Thrawn being a major part, then we know that we're going to see Ezra IRL. But they're having fun with this kind of like, he's only on the hologram. Is it, where is he? It's very mysterious, very awesome. I love Mary Elizabeth Winstead as Hera. That's super fun. What great casting.
Incredible casting. And now we have husband and wife in the Star Wars universe. Where do you think Ezra and Thrawn are? How much of the upcoming Ahsoka season is the search for Ezra? And how early do they find him, you think?
I think the Ezra search is going to be a key part of the mystery. I think Ezra and Thrawn are somewhere on the Outer Rim. That's generally like my feeling of where Thrawn has been. And I feel like with the stuff we're seeing in The Mandalorian is probably tying into that. What has Thrawn been up to? That's the big question. And that's kind of something, again, that we get into in The Mandalorian. Like, what is his plan? What is his scheme? And how is he going to play into the future of what we see? I mean, I'm so excited to see live action Ezra. I love him so much. Okay, this is a question I have for you, because one of the things I immediately thought about, so I love Rebels, obviously, you love Rebels. The end of Rebels was like so crazy because they gave us not only like one of the best final couple of episodes of all time, but when we get that skip forward to see where everyone is, we meet Hera's kid, you know, who's named after Luke Skywalker's kid from Legends, Jason. And that was like this huge thing, this huge moment, right? I was like, are we going to see the kids? Da, da, da. But when do you think this takes place? Because I think there's been a lot of conversation of, is this between the end of what we saw in Rebels and that's where we meet them in the skip forward? Is it in between that time? Is it after that time? Whereabouts do you think it's going to take place?
I think it's going to take place like before the skip forward, while the rebellion is still happening, and or maybe even just brewing. Like, I think it's going to be very close to Andor. I think it's going to be close in time to when Andor happened. But I don't think it's going to be. I don't think it's going to be after the skip forward. I think it might be before. That's just a guess.
Between.
What do you,
think? I think you're right. I would love to see the skip forward life because I love the idea of seeing the kids. But the truth is that it makes a lot of sense from what we know and what we saw at the end of Rebels that this essentially acts as almost like a expansion. It's a nice inversion of what we're used to with the animated series, where the animated series builds out what we've seen in live action. I like the idea that this is a huge expansion of this tiny moment that we got in the animated series. It looks so good. I can't even.
It looks
It's
really
just kind
great.
Of mind blowing. I think that you're absolutely right. If this show blows up and becomes the biggest Disney Plus show of all time or in a long time since WandaVision, whatever the biggest one is, then I think that Filoni show becomes a near certainty.
Yeah.
So I think you're absolutely right. I think those two things are directly connected.
One more thing about the timeline. You know, one of the things that these projects, you know, one of the Jenga obstacles that these projects kind of have to thread is, you know, why wasn't Ahsoka at the Battle of Yavin? Where were Din and Grogu during XYZ fight? And I think that to me is, you can really kind of solve that with this show and show that like, oh, Ahsoka was tied up doing whatever. That's why.
Yeah, even like World Beyond Worlds. You know, yeah. If you want to get into that kind of strange, more mystical side of the Force that Sabine and everyone from Rebels is a little bit more aligned to, it's a lot easier to argue why they weren't necessarily involved in like a military rebellion.
Next up, the Acolyte. They showed footage from this, but no footage yet has come out publicly. They also did that for Andor, but that was apparently just kind of like a sizzle reel. So the Acolyte is, this is our High Republic show. 100 years before The Phantom Menace, created by Leslie Headland of Russian Doll fame, and it's a star-studded cast, including Amanda Stenberg, Lee Jung-jae, Manny Jacinto, and more. This is super exciting, and
yeah,
I'm sure fans
wait.
Of the High Republic books and comics are going to be pretty stoked.
Yeah, I think that they definitely actually bought in Vanessa Rowe, who was from the High Republic novels. They announced that Rebecca Henderson would be playing her. We got Junus, who took over playing Chewbacca from Peter Mayhew. He's getting to create a new Wookiee Jedi, which is really cool. And also, this is going to be our first time with a movie or a TV show that is directly focused on a true villain. Even though obviously there are some movies like the prequels, you could argue that all of Star Wars and the prequels is about Darth Vader, but you know, they each have their heroes. This is going to be about a young Sith acolyte who is played by Amanda Stenberg. And Leslie Headland pitched it to Lucasfilm as Frozen meets Kill Bill. Idea is it's kind of this like And the Frozen aspect comes from this idea of you think this person is the villain, but here is their story. Mm. And the Kill Bill aspect is because it's going to be like a badass revenge story. But what I thought was really interesting is Leslie said, this is the Sith when they are just the ultimate underdogs. This is at a time when the Jedi is ruling everything.
Yeah.
Like everything is Jedi, High Republic, utopian state. So if you are a dark side Force user, if you are a Sith, you are like a non-citizen. You don't really exist. So that was kind of the intrigue that she laid out there. I mean, Russian Dolls is one of the best TV shows I've seen in a long time with the incredible, obviously, Natasha Lyonne, who we love. So, and it's really subversive and weird and twisty, and it totally turns the time loop on its head. So the fact they're letting Leslie do one of these shows, and it has, like you said, this Squid Game stuff. Daphne Keane has X-23 in it. You know, this is just like Jodie Turner-Smith, icon. Like so many good, Carrie Ann Moss playing a Jedi. I guess that kind of seemed to leak from what they'd said, from the what they'd shown at the show. It just looks and sounds very, very cool. And I would love to see it. Like, I'm not a Sith apologist. I don't feel like Leslie's going to do some, like, you should feel sorry for the Sith. But I always want to see a different side.
I would love to see a different side.
Of this world that we love.
I will say that the way it was described felt a little bit like, it's your fault I'm the Sith. You know what I mean? Like, the Jedi, why are you making me use the dark side? Don't,
you know? I will say that the Frozen comparison does make you think that's a story about the Ice Queen. You know, this traditional villain. So you wonder, like, what could that argument be? It will be very interesting to see. This is 100 years, like you said, before The Phantom Menace. So the politics and things that drove the Sith could arguably be established to be very different. We could learn very different things. But yeah, I'm interested to see it. I'm sure it's going to be really cool and great and probably totally upend whatever we're expecting it to be. But I'm ready for them to release that footage because I want to see it.
Switching universes now, the Marvels trailer dropped, hitting theaters November 10th, 2023. Here is our first Marvel project that is unambiguously launched by the television offerings of the MCU, starring Brie Larson as Captain Marvel, Iman Vellani as Kamala Khan, Tiona Paris as Monica Rambeau, and Samuel L. Jackson returns as our friend Nick Fury. New villain, Dar-Ben, played by Zoe Ashton, one of the weirder minor Avengers villains you'll ever see.
You're really getting into that joyous space here that we've talked about many times before. This is a character who has two appearances. This is the classic. But I will say, the trailer looks so cute. I was loving it. I was slightly nervous about this one, but it came out looking beautiful.
It looked great.
It looks gorgeous. I definitely think that they have strayed. I think originally this was meant to have more of an Ant-Man color palette from all the marketing that they did. And I feel like they've strayed from that. I think this looks so cute. I love Kamala. I love the interactions they're having. The Rick Jones kind of body switching, Freaky Friday, which we saw teased at the end of Ms. Marvel. But all of that is to say, I do need to talk about Darben because there's two appearances. But
please,
look. This is the truth, yeah? Zawe, who's absolutely stunning British actor in this unbelievable film called Dreams of a Life, theater icon, just wonderful. This is a character who's a Cree, only had a couple appearances, but, and look, I might be getting carried away, but this is a very specific character and the appearances are very important. In their first appearance, they debuted in an Infinity Gauntlet crossover issue from 1991 that was Silver Surfer 53. So first of all, there's a Silver Surfer connection. They established this, which I think could come into play in this film, which is it's this pink and blue Kree war, which is this idea that there's two different kinds of Kree, basically human-looking Kree like Captain Marvel, and blue Kree, who you have seen in Ronan the Accuser. And there's this, it's like a kind of clunky recurring part of Kree lore. But in this comic, Darben teams up with Aiel Dan, who is a blue, and they decide they're going to do a coup of the Kree and become a joint kind of force to rule Kree for the good. And they're going to bring the pinks and the blues together. How do they do this in this issue, in the debut issue? They use the Silver Surfer to murder basically the person that the Supreme Intelligence had put in place as a Kree leader. So are we going to see Silver Surfer in this movie? Probably not, but that is a direct Silver Surfer connection. And interestingly, they don't actually really use the Silver Surfer. They use a robot of the Silver Surfer. Feels very relevant to me. And you mentioned Avengers, because they were an Avengers villain in Avengers 346, which is the part of the massive Avengers crossover Galactic Storm, which you may know because it became a video game. And the Avengers are on Hala, where we know that at least some of this movie is probably going to take place, the Kree homeworld. Right? Yeah. And this is really, I think, as I'm a Silver Surfer stan, so I had to bring up the first appearance connection, but this is really what I think is exciting and weird about them choosing this character. This is a massive X-Men storyline. And in this issue, it's a Kree versus the Shi'ar storyline, like a key part of X-Men lore.
Yeah.
And this isn't, you know, Darben and Aiel Dan, their little Kree pink and blue kind of leadership party that they're trying to make, they end up getting killed by none other than Deathbird, who is the sister of Lalandra, who is, you know, Charles Xavier's lover and has all these connections with Corsair and these different kind of key X-Men characters. So this feels like there are places that they can go with this if they want to dive into the Marvel cosmic and how it connects to bigger characters like Silver Surfer and also the X-Men. And that's the second to last issue of Galactic Storm. And the next issue is called Annihilation. And we haven't seen a big Marvel Annihilation yet. So I feel like there's so much fun stuff. Also, importantly for me, this is the issue where the Avengers get their jackets and officially become the Jacket Avengers.
I just want to see.
It's huge.
When we go to Hala, I just want to see the old school Supreme Kree Intelligence, not played by Annette Bening, like the big head in the jar.
The big, scary head in the jar. We need to see it.
And
also, it does seem like in those two issues that Darben is in, it's like the Kree Intelligence has kind of been manipulating the Shi'ar so they will kill these people who want to take over. And it does look like, from what we've seen, that Carol is going to have to go to Hala and fight. It looks like she fights Darben. I just wonder if we're going to see some aspects of this idea of somebody trying to take over the Kree home planet of Hala, reimagine the way that it should be run, and then have Carol have to go back and like save her planet. I'm doing big inverted commas here because Carol's not been very good at that so far in her canon. And all of that is very deep cosmic lore that I am excited about. But what I really want to see is these three characters switching bodies like Freaky Friday.
One more thing. Monica's got to stop touching stuff.
Please.
It's so funny in the trailer. It's like she's, you know, floating up to an alien energy space portal. And it's like, once again, you're touching. Stop touching.
She's just like, what's this?
Now, you rightly pointed out that listen, the last time she touched a weird thing, she got powers. Mm-hmm. And I think if there is one lesson you take away from not just Marvel comics, but superhero comics in general, is like, touch it. Touch the radiation. Touch mm-hmm. the radioactive spider. Like, let the radiation spill on your face. All of the weird things mm-hmm. that you definitely shouldn't do. Get locked in the room that will bombard mm-hmm. you with energy. Like, all of the stuff, like, touch it. But still, Monica, there's no way this is scientific.
It's not
Don't
a good
touch
idea.
The thing. And stop also touching
after,
stuff.
Especially after this specific touching where you send a teen into space in your place, I think you can learn that touching is bad. Also, I will say something interesting about this, especially that shows up when Monica touches something she shouldn't touch. They say this is a Saber space station where her and Sam, aka Nick Fury, are. So I'm very interested because Saber is not something that's in the comics, and I guess it's going to be an arm of S.W.O.R.D. or a different version of S.W.O.R.D., maybe something to separate S.W.O.R.D. off from the Skrulls who helped establish it. But I thought that was an interesting note. But yeah, looks really fun. We don't know much about it yet, but Dar-Ben is a great deep cut pull that can hint, and we get to see these three having like a ton of fun.
All right, up next, The Mandalorian. Get ready to be transported to 1973 New York City with Stiffed, the new podcast from Crooked Media and iHeartRadio. In this 8-part series, host Jennifer Romolini takes you on a wild ride through the rise and fall of Viva, the erotic magazine for women started by porn king Bob Guccione, founder of Penthouse, that rocked the publishing world. With a team of feminist writers and editors behind it, Viva, in its original form, had full frontal male nudity, a fashion section run by Anna Wintour herself, and cover stars like Bianca Jagger. But were they doomed to fail from the beginning? Check out the first 4 episodes of Stiffed right now. Listen for free on your favorite podcast platform. Stiffed, it's stiffening.
Are you spending more time in your basement now that it's your rec room, office, kids' playroom, or home gym? Well, you need to ventilate those spaces to remove stagnant, musty air. For over 20 years, the Easy Breathe ventilation system exchanges dirty, damp air for cleaner, drier, healthier air. Take charge of your indoor air with your own Easy Breathe ventilation system. You can get it installed, or DIY kits are available. Just call 866-822-7328 or visit takechargeofyourair.com and receive 20% off today.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. If tonight's movie night is just what you need, make it special with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Are you spending more time in your basement now that it's your rec room, office, kids' playroom, or home gym? Well, you need to ventilate those spaces to remove stagnant, musty air. For over 20 years, the Easy Breathe ventilation system exchanges dirty, damp air for cleaner, drier, healthier air. Take charge of your indoor air with your own Easy Breathe ventilation system. You can get it installed, or DIY kits are available. Just call 866-822-7328 or visit takechargeofyourair.com and receive 20% off today.
Folks, we're stepping out of the airlock and into a galaxy far, far away for season 3, episode 7 of The Mandalorian, titled Chapter 23, The Spies. We will talk a lot about what
spies.
That means in the course of this recap. Directed by Rick Famuyiwa and written by Jon Favreau and a guy named David Filoni, who you might have heard of.
May have heard of.
We open on Coruscant, down on the street level, where all the gritty, grimy, really dangerous stuff happens.
Blade Runner neon lights.
It looks gorgeous.
It's happening.
And we see G-68, Elia Kane. She's out of Amnesty House, skulking around the alleyways. She meets her contact, an Imperial probe joint. It connects G to her boss. Moff Gideon, hello.
We were right, just saying.
We were right. I mean, we knew.
I mean, everyone knew, but it was him. Most obvious thing of all time. Come on, New Republic.
G then tells Gideon that the pirates on Navarro ran into a little trouble. And he's like, oh, was it the, you said the New Republic wouldn't get involved. And she's like, well, it wasn't the New Republic. It was Mandalorians led by Din Djarin and Bo-Katan. Gideon is pissed, but that's what happens when you hire amateurs to do a job that should have been should have been a pro job. And he's alarmed because Bo and Din together doing something, leading a force of Mandalorians, that represents a potential unification of Mandalorian tribes that were previously at each other's necks. And that is a threat to whatever plans he has. So he's like, okay, I'll deal with this. He gets off the phone with G and walks back to his Zoom call. He's having a Zoom call with a bunch of commanders from what will eventually be the First Order. And they're talking about how they need to continue to pretend to be disorganized, like Imperial remnant warlords, just like hijacking ships and doing weird crimes across the galaxy, when in reality, what they're hiding is that they are a unified force of Imperials who's hoping to, you know, spoiler alert, bring Imperial rule back to the galaxy. And the person who they are hoping to lead them there is none other than
friend
from the Chiss, the Chiss immigrant himself, Grand Admiral Thrawn. Bam, bam, bam.
It's a huge moment. We get a funny Legends throwback with Captain Pelion, who was a Thrawn ally, who kind of talks about it here. So this is probably the most important Zoom call of the galaxy.
Absolutely. Now, there's only one problem, and that's since the end of Rebels, Thrawn is missing. No one knows where he's at, and there are doubts swirling about whether he's gone for good. And one of the people on the Zoom, and you can count, by the way, Moff Gideon is one of those people, because he's definitely like, you know.
He's a dad.
Where is this guy? Now, one of the people on the Zoom is Commandant Brendel Hux, dad of future screamer General Hux, General Nepo Armitage
baby.
Hux. Nepo baby, one of the Nepo babies himself. Now, Daddy Hux is working on something called Project Necromancer, which we're going to go ahead and guess is Project Bring Palpy Back, right? Gotta be.
It's gotta be. I mean, the name is so good and over the top and just totally fun and silly. And it's exactly what it says, Project Necromancer. They want to bring people back from the dead. And we know that that will lead to Palpy somehow coming back in the sequel trilogy. I love this name. Totally silly, totally TV pulp serialized nonsense, and I'm so happy that it's canon and it's so creepy and good. And yeah, it's bringing Palpy back.
And now Moff Gideon is like, well, let's talk about this Thrawn stuff for a second. He says, quote, I hear whispers from one end of the galaxy to the other, basically saying no one's more plugged into what people are talking about than me. And then he continues, he says, and never a word of Thrawn. You have spoken of his imminent return. Perhaps it's time we look to new leadership. Yeah, where is this guy? This guy's been gone. No one knows where he is. And the Necromancer comes back up. Hux is like, okay, well, you're shitting on our Thrawn dreams. Whatever happened with Dr. Pershing, who apparently is the only guy in the fucking galaxy capable of doing genetic research? It's like, we need this guy for Necromancer, whatever Necromancer is. And Gideon is like, oh yeah, sorry, the New Republic got him, but like, I've got my people on that. I'm working on that. He doesn't say more than that, but he suggests that he'll have a fix for that soon. Hux then calls out Gideon for doing some like off the books research with Pershing on Navarro that no one knows about and then he refuses to talk about. And Gideon very, very ably sidesteps the topic, doesn't admit that, yes, I was on Navarro doing research with Dr. Pershing that I'm not going to talk about. He basically just like flips the accusation. It's like, no. Clones are your obsession, not mine. I was doing some other fucking shit over there, which we find out at the end of this episode exactly what that was, which is taking the best bits of different warrior societies and creating his super soldiers. Gideon then flips the discussion again is like, okay, but what are you guys going to do for me right now? Because you all have been hoarding resources, mm-hmm. and I need stuff. What do I need? Here's my shopping list. I need Praetorian guards.
Dun dun dun.
I need TIE interceptors. I need TIE bombers. And they're like, man, this is some serious weaponry for, like, what are you scared of, an assassination attempt? He's like, well, you know, like, here's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about Mandalorians. They're coming back. They're coming back for their homeworld. And as we all know, people on this Zoom, we have some important projects going on Mandalore, and we don't want to share it. So give me my stuff. And it's pretty clear that he's going to get his stuff. We go to Navarro, where an Imperial fleet shows up over the town. But then it turns out, no, Greef Karga says, don't worry, my terrified protocol droid. That's not the Imperials. Look at the paint on the bottom, that mythosaur skull on the bottom of that light cruiser. Those are the Mandalorians. Now, let me ask you, how many gallons of paint did it take to paint the bottom of this? Like a billion gallons of paint?
At least, to be able to see it. You're talking about a year of manpower and like so much paint you can't even comprehend it. I can't
24
even imagine.
Working 24 hours a day.
This is like, if you did the zoom in, you'd see one man and he'd be painting like white and you'd zoom out and it would be like, you know, a centimeter on there, and you have to have like 25,000 men. I don't know how they did it. Good for them. Maybe the baby did it with the force, but yeah, too much paint is how much it costs.
So the Mandalorian fleet, containing, of course, Axe Woves' people, and of course, Bo, Grogu, and Din, is making landfall by this, you know, that new parcel of real estate gifted by Greef Karga. Mm. And the armorer and her folks are already there. Now, Bo is worried because the helmet ons and the helmet offs, these two groups don't get along. They don't like each other. We all know about the history of internecine squabbling between Mandalorian sects. But Din is like, no, they'll cooperate because they need to survive. The armorer welcomes everybody and says, hey, we're going to make dinner. What do you guys want for dinner? Greef then comes up. He's got a gift of booze, one bottle of booze for like however many Mandalorians showed
up. It's a shame because like this was a good idea. Like get them drunk so they get along. Yeah. It was a good idea. But like what's everyone having? Like one tiny sniff? I don't even know if everyone's getting a sip.
But that's not all. He's got something very, very special planned, and it's baby's first Gundam suit. And Anzellan Mechanic comes into Greef's office, and he's driving the chassis of IG-11, now known as IG-12, because they've lobotomized IG-11, taken out all his memory and drive circuits. So it's just kind of like the stuff that keeps him working, the core systems, and then there's a little pilot's platform on the chest where the pilot can stand and just with two little joysticks, like run IG-12. It's more like a vehicle, Greef says, because Din is like, this is weird. And Din is like, okay, well, Grogu's too, he's a baby. We can't, can we really have him driving
just
cars?
Just keep the Anzellian in there, surely. Yeah, like, you're not going to put the baby in there.
And Grogu's like, no, I want to do it. I want to do it.
Grogu wants to be in a mech. Who can blame
absolutely.
Him? Baby in a mech.
Grogu gets in the mech, and Din is like, okay, this is all fun and games, but get out. And there's apparently two buttons on the console, one for yes and one for no. And Grogu is just like, every time Din is like, get out, he's like, no. And then Greef is like, he seems like he's doing well. He's piloting pretty well. And then Grogu's like, yes.
And he just like strong arms Mando too. Like, Mando's like, you better get out. And he's like, nope, I've got a body now. He's like, bye.
And then he just starts stumbling out to like the market street, grabbing fruit and crushing it, like just to show like what he could do and making Daddy Din have to pay for all this fruit.
Din's like, you have
crushes.
To pay for that. Like, what is going on here? This is a terrible. I'm happy the baby got a mech, but on a parental level, I understand. Why Din does not want the baby.
I understand. Now, there's no, as far as we know, IG-11 was, of course, a very, very dangerous robot, but with like blasters and stuff.
You know?
And it appears that there's no, you know, built-in hardware, weaponry on IG-12. So I know, I do wonder.
I think Grief made the mech with the intention of it being for Grogu. I think from the moment that Din had his insane, very Project Necromancer idea to take this poor dead body of this droid that had been turned into a statue and try and reanimate it with a brain chip card that, by the way, Din just got distracted and never got.
Hey, we don't care about the brain chip card.
We don't care about that anymore.
We're trying to repopulate Mandalore. We don't have time for side quests.
Got to go for a bath. The side quest is over. The side quest has been taken over by a more important side quest. And I think that from that very moment, the Anzillians, who love the bad baby, they think he's quite cheeky, and Grief, I think they came up with this plan. So really, Din's been outvoted. But does it have weapons? Probably not. Seems like it'd be a silly idea, but it does feel like we're going to get to see some hefty Grogu action in the finale.
I understand that he has the little Beskar chest plate that is just held on by the tension of his robe. But like, can we get a blast cover? Like,
I know, can he just, I think so he's got to have
exposed.
He needs the helmet
in the front
now.
Of it. Yeah, he
the
needs
time
something.
Has come.
Something like a canopy with a little like a little like bombardier slit so that you can see.
Oh, I like that.
I just feel like he's like everybody's gonna be shooting at center mass at IG-12.
Yeah, even
and
just
it's like
a pull down, something. You know, a little shield. Something.
I can't have the baby get hit. But it looks fantastic job. Great idea, Grief. I love it. That night over some roast gigantic animal that the Mandalorians killed because they love to do that. The helmet ons and offs are eyeing each other warily. And Bo is like, okay, we got to pull it together speech. She gets up, she makes the speech, she proposes returning to Mandalore. She's like, we're going to go to Mandalore with a scouting party. We're going to find the Great Forge. And then once we've secured that, we're going to create a little base. And that at that point, we're going to start bringing people back to Mandalore. We're going to retake the planet. So I want volunteers for the scouting party, and it's got to be from both tribes, which is a great idea. And there's no shortage of takers. And that group includes Din, Grogu, Axe Wolves, Paz, and many, many more. But those are the hefties.
It becomes, it's very Spartacus. At first, people are a little wary, and then Din says yes, and then suddenly it's this is the way, and everybody's going.
And they head out with, honestly, for how many people say yes, a shocking amount of ships. They take the light cruiser.
Are they wasting the ships?
And like
I don't
a
know.
Dozen
it felt like
other
a lot
ships.
Of ships.
They take what looked like the entire fleet goes to Mandalore. Now they arrive on Mandalore and they just take one of the smaller, you know, scout ships, and they go through the atmosphere. Of course, Bo takes pains to, you know, tell everybody, hey, when we go down, we're gonna be cut off. Nobody's gonna be able to communicate with us. And then they land. And then for some reason, Bo is like, hey, the Great Forge is like somewhere in that direction. Let's walk.
I need to know.
Bo, why are we not flying? Like, just fucking fly there. Why Literally, are we walking?
You all fitted in that one ship. You can just fly. Just fly till you see it and then land, babe.
Just fly.
It's not exactly a scenic walk. Like, this is not good time.
And by the way, and my other thing. And the Mandalorians, I think part of, obviously, the squabbling is a big factor in you know, why they've found themselves in that position. Not to victim blame again, but it was a factor. And then I think another factor that they need to learn is like combined arms. Like if the ships can't communicate with the other ships through the atmosphere, just have everybody come down into the atmosphere. Like, why stay up there? Everybody come down. Because the upside of that is anybody that might come, enemies that might come looking for, they have no idea where the fuck you are because they can't scan through the atmosphere. And now you can communicate with your people if they're all in the atmosphere. Don't just leave most of the ships up there and you don't know where they are. And then you walk away from your spaceship. So what happens if there's like an emergency? You got to run back to the fucking ship, like 10 miles or however far you guys walked.
Bad ideas.
Anyway, just take the ships.
Please.
Why are we walking? Later, encounter like this really, really cool like sailing barge that slides across the glass. Very reminiscent of the kind of walker that Rex and the older clones were living in when we catch up with them again in season two of Rebels, the episode Lost Commanders. Really, really cool to see this. It floats up. And big surprise for Bo, it's crewed by remnants of the Night Owls, which were an elite fighting force that was once sworn to Bo. And they make it clear that, hey, we're still with you. We have failed you, they say, but our blasters remain in your service. It's a very touching moment. They look haggard.
Like, they've been going through it.
They've been going through it. The very first thing they ask is, hey, you guys got food?
Got any more giant roasted beasts?
Hey, you guys, yeah, you guys got any of the meat? Of
giant mythosaur jerky, anything?
Giant beast meat. So everyone gets on the Night Owl ship because, again, they left their ship behind in what could only be described as one of the most unwise moves we've ever seen. You guys could have just gotten on your regular ship that had, like, weapons and stuff. Anyway, the Night Owls then tell the story of surviving on the planet while the Purge was going on. They apparently, like, moved across the surface from place to place, just kind of, like, dancing through the fusion bombs. And they say of their experience, you know, the Empire punished us because we refused to surrender. And Bo then says, no, that's actually not true. And she tells them that in her desperation, when it seemed like everything was lost and Mandalorians truly faced extinction, she met with Moff Gideon and basically forged a deal that they would submit to the Empire and disarm, and then all the Mandalorians would be spared. And of course, Moff Gideon double-crossed them and just decided to, like, kill everybody anyway, and then took the Darksaber. A huge admission. It's a huge, huge reveal. And it's also, you know, for a Mandalorian to actually surrender, that is must have been really, really weighing on Bo.
Yeah, it gives a lot of complexity to Bo, a character that I feel like a lot of people either love or have a quite complex relationship with after seeing her in the TV animated stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that Bo, the way they've treated Bo here and the performance that Katie gives and the additions of context around the choices that she made, especially this conversation, is really huge. And I think it adds a lot to the character and to what we know about Mandalore.
Agreed. The arrival of the Night Owls now adds another faction to this very combustible mix of Mandalorians. Bo insists again, hey, we need to overcome our divisions. We got to avoid these mistakes that have torn us apart in the past if we want to rebuild. Din comes away with a real appreciation for Bo and for the way the Helmet Offs live their version of Mandalorianness. And he notes, he says, like, you know, basically says, we're survivors, right? He says, quote, we'll rebuild it. Isn't that our history? And Bo, you know, talks openly, very vulnerably about her fears about not being the leader that this moment needs. She says, I don't know if I can keep everyone together, which I think is the thing that you want your leader to worry about.
Yeah.
You know, that's
100%.
You definitely want that. You don't want I got it.
Exactly.
I'm the person
That's always what goes wrong. You always want the person who doesn't think they can be a leader to be the leader because they're being chosen by the people around them.
Yeah.
Very interesting moment between Din and Bo here because he just straight up says to her, like, I will serve you.
Yeah.
He says, I will serve you because you have honor, because I trust you. And I think Bo being vulnerable and Bo being honest, it upends what Din has been told, what the Death Watch used to say about her. She was selfish. She would never surrender. She wouldn't fight hard enough.
Yeah.
He learns here that that was essentially propaganda, that this is a real human who tried to make a decision to save her people and was betrayed. And this is a huge... This man has gone from being a bounty hunter who works for money and credits to now saying he pledges his allegiance to Bo and he will try and rebuild Mandalore with her. That's massive.
It's massive. And it's, I love that Bo is really grabbing the mantle of Duchess Satine, who similarly was just trying to hold her people together, trying to forge this new path, a political path, a less warlike path,
mm-hmm.
And was, you know, the focus of a lot of violence from her own people for it.
Yeah.
And now here is Bo essentially doing the same thing, but after, you know, her people have almost been wiped out. It's really heartrending.
I love now, that many, catch.
Now, many of the Night Owls are not well. They've been living on the surface of this bombed planet, eating who knows what. And
crystals? So, I don't know. Not, crystals, not healthy.
Something. So the armorer is like, I'll take them back up to the ships that we left for some reason up in orbit, and I'll be back.
And let's remember that as we go forward.
Yeah, yeah. And the rest of them, the Night Owls, like, who are good enough, who apparently who are healthy enough to continue, they're like, oh, the Great Forge? Yeah, yeah, we know it. Like, just, it's right over here. So they head there. Later, on the ship, as they're en route to the Great Forge, Paz and Axe get in a fight over a board game, which I get it. I've been there.
It happens. It's relatable.
It immediately turns into this kind of, like, symbolic fight of between these two tribes, and no one is sure what to do. The blades come out. Bo is a little bit frozen by it. You know, like protocol would seem to suggest,
yes,
like, you don't get involved.
You
in
can't
this.
Do it because it's two separate tribes, so you're not supposed to overstep.
You're not supposed
and stop
to
stop it.
And Din follows Bo's lead, but of course, Grogu doesn't. Grogu has the liberty and the clarity of being, like, disconnected from this history, and steps up with his mech between them, and everybody actually chills out. They're a little chastened, because when a baby is like, you guys are acting like babies, that it really hits.
Yeah, when a baby in a Krang suit is like, please calm down.
Soon after this, a giant kaiju monster, not the mythosaur, bursts
not
through the surface.
The mythosaur, confusing.
Very confusing, and This is a fantastic episode of the Mandalorian television program. But this was the only moment where I was like, we already are primed to be waiting to see the Mythosaur again. It's a little weird to then have a very similar looking
giant
beast,
sea monster, like, that arrives at and it comes at like a important time,
yeah,
and it seems to be doing something that's relevant, but it's just a sea monster. Just a cool sea monster, which, great, because I love a cool sea monster. So I appreciate it, but slightly confusing.
It then wrecks the Night Owl's barge. Not every Mandalorian makes it out. You see several casualties in this explosion, but thankfully the Mandalorians with dialogue do manage to make it off the ship. And the new Mandalorians then head underground for shelter, and they come to the ruins of the Great Forge. Suddenly, they are ambushed by death troopers with jetpacks clad in Beskar.
Yeah.
The fight is brutal.
They basically look like stormtroopers crossed with Mandalorians.
Absolutely. They
it's,
have jet,
it's
you know, like,
unbelievable,
flying.
Totally unexpected. And like you said, that fight is brutal. Like, they seem equally matched, which we don't usually see with any kind of trooper.
It goes, there's shooting, it's hand to hand, it's really bad. And so Axe is like, I'll go for reinforcements to the ships that we left outside the atmosphere that we should have just, like, had trailing us. But I'll go. And I guess, how would he fly, like, all the way up?
I know. How did he refill his jetpack? Because we know he didn't when he was looking for his son.
But how would, no, this is Axe.
Oh, it's
Axe.
Well,
he's gonna go,
he seems like he would be better.
No, but I'm saying, like, can you fly all the way up into orbit with just the jetpack? Like, didn't the armor take the ship?
I know.
How is he getting up there?
Seems unlikely, but I guess they're space mercenaries, so maybe.
I trust him. I trust the Axe knows what he's doing. And so anyway, Axe goes up. And in this really heartwarming sign of the unity that this tribe is experiencing now, Paz is like, I will lay down covering fire. He lays down covering fire, and Axe flies up through the hole. The new Mandos beat the troopers back, and they go to pursue and finish off their wounded enemy. But then they find themselves in a trap. It's a hidden Imperial base. There's TIE interceptors all around. And it is Gideon that has sprung the trap. Gideon takes Din hostage. As the rest of the party, you know, trapped behind the blast doors, watches helplessly. Grogu is like crying. Moff then tells the new Mandalorians that what he's been up to. And here, and here, this basically tells us what he was using Grogu for. He says, like, you know, I'm taking all the best bits from all the best warriors from all around the galaxy. Beskar from the Mandalorians. DNA from Jedi, our little friend Grogu over there. Other stuff. And I'm going to create this, like, super, super soldier army. And with that army, I'm going to fucking conquer the galaxy. He then is like, gets on the horn with his TIE bombers and is like, go destroy the ships. Gideon then makes Bo an offer. Listen, surrender right now. Give me the Darksaber. Tell all your Mandalorians to lay down their weapons and follow me, and I'll spare everyone. But, like, how can you trust the guy? It's absolutely a hard no. They start shooting at the glass, which doesn't do anything, but, like, these guys love to shoot and stuff. And then Bo cuts a hole through the blast door in the back, and they all escape. Meanwhile, the front blast door opens, and here come all these Death Troopers. And Paz is like, I'm fucking going out like a fucking Viking. I'm going out like a hero. He goes... He basically goes like on a 50-person killing streak. It's like a 50-to-1 KD ratio until those Praetorians that Moff Gideon ordered on Imperial Amazon arrive, and they take him out.
Yeah, and a great scene. A really great
scene. And it's R.I.P. to Paz.
R.I.P. to Paz. He did great. I hope he's not really dead, but he's definitely really dead.
He's definitely dead.
They murk him. Also, I just want to mention, Moff Gideon has like sick... Darth Vader crossed with Mandalorian
Captain Phasma,
armor.
Like,
Captain Phasma. Yeah, and I think he calls it is a dark trooper armor that he's created, and it's this Beskar Darth Vader armor. And obviously, he basically made it because he wants to have the dark saber and be the dark trooper. That's not happening for him.
Very
he's
emo
that
guy.
Saber.
Yeah,
so emo. But this is really cool. I love this unexpected twist. This kind of dueling idea of wanting to rule Mandalore. Bo wants to do it for the Mandalorians and the people, and Gideon sees it as like a power vacuum where he can become
vacuum.
A new version of Mandalore.
A free planet.
Yeah.
Filled with weapons and Beskar. Mm-hmm. Like, why don't I just set up base right here and use this as a launching pad to take over the galaxy?
Yeah, very outrageous scheme. I don't think it's going to go well for him, just looking at what we know of Star Wars history. But this was a very cool episode. Rick just absolutely smashed it once again. I think if anyone had been feeling, we have been big fans of the more out there side quest episodes because we love that kind of stuff. I loved the Plazier 15. I thought it was so fun. Yeah. But I feel like if people have been looking for that, how does it all come together and how does this impact stuff going forwards? This is that episode where the loose threads begin to be tied together and we start to get a inkling of the greater plan.
Rosie, the title of this episode is The Spies. Now, G68, Elliot Kane, is definitely a spy. So plural spies, there's a lot of conjecture on the internets right now about who the other spies are. Who do you think the other spies are? I mean, certainly there are some suspects. I found it weird that we had that armorer scene in there where she just flies up with the night owls, and then you think that you're going to see the attack on the fleet, but then you never see it.
That definitely
also
seems suspicious.
Axe Woves also is like, I guess I'm going to fly my jetpack all the way to space and get to the ships. Like,
yeah.
So there's people who left in weird circumstances.
And we did get that thing, that moment at the beginning of the episode last week where the Mandalorians who Axe leads mentioned that, like, yeah, we'll be honorable for a few credits. So there's still that duality of, like, do they really believe that Bo won the lightsaber fairly? Would they betray her? I think this is really interesting because, as the internet has pointed out, as we've talked about, the titles of the Mandalorian episodes are usually incredibly literal.
Yeah, very, very literal.
Very literal. So it seems odd to be in a situation where we don't know exactly what this is referencing to. And you made a great point before we started recording that it's rare for them to want you to be ahead of the story.
Yeah, that's usually just like a storytelling 101.
Right?
Never let the audience be ahead of it. But like, if you're going to reveal that there's a betrayer amongst the Mandalorians, don't let people be looking for that person because it'll ruin the reveal.
I wonder I wonder if they want that conversation, because another person that I think could, we could think about it as being about Moff Gideon, because mm-hmm. he's part of this Imperial Zoom and he's using the technology and the resources that they have while doing his own thing to try and take over the galaxy himself. So is he technically a spy in that space because he's betraying them? I think the armorer thing is a really great call. I also wonder if maybe there is somebody within Moff Gideon's ranks who is actually potentially a spy for our Mandalorians who might turn in that way. I think that we could be in a possibility here because of the plural nature and the fact that it's obviously not just about Elia, who obviously is a spy. Mm-mm. We could have a big surprise in the finale of having a few different, maybe a spy network that we don't know about or something. It's a very interesting choice.
Here's my argument against the armor slash axe wolves as spies from Moff Gideon. Wouldn't he know more stuff? Like, why would he need G-68 then to tell him
that
the
Mandalorians
interfered with the pirates? Because he would just be getting that
directly from
the armor.
Them.
Yeah, from them. So it, I wonder, again, considering how, as you mentioned, like the titles are always very, very just what it is on the surface level, like, you know, no subtext, just text. I wonder if like Moff Gideon is the spy because as we see in this episode, he is working against what the rest of the First Order, even though they're not the First Order yet. He is kind of working against what they wanted. They're all like, we can't wait for Daddy Thrawn to come home. And he's like, no, 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 we're not looking
he's
for
like, who's
guy.
Thrawn? Where is he? Never heard of him.
But it's fascinating. And I do wonder where. I wonder how much more Coruscant and G-68 we're going to get. And I wonder how much more of that there is. It would seem as if, unless that spy network is going to get revealed, it would seem like we're kind of done with her, right?
Yeah.
Like,
they got what they needed.
Yeah.
But she's so great, Katie O'Brien as Elia. There's such a kind of nefarious energy that she puts across that I wouldn't be surprised if they try and reveal. Oh, you know what I suppose, and this would fit into conversations we'd had before, I wonder if the spies is more to do with Elia potentially running a spy network within the amnesty program or something like that. You know, I wonder if that will come into play in the finale, that like you, that particular storyline and how she helped Gideon is done. But maybe that Imperial network is a lot stronger than we thought. And we'll kind of see the resurgence in the finale. As we know, this is now all leading to that sequel trilogy.
Yeah, I just can't. I think it would be an audacious reveal if the armorer was like a spy for the, like, that would be absolutely incredible. Like a Game
You'd
of
be
Thrones
shocked.
Level, yeah. Like, flip. That if you did it right, that would be a gut punch, but I can't get there. Like, why was she so helpful on Navarro then when they were fighting the pirates? Why didn't she just kind of like not try that? She didn't need
they'd
to try
have
that
to
hard.
Have, yeah, they'd have to have an ultimately brilliant, it all comes together reasoning.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're a spy, you have to play both sides. You have to be believable. But as you mentioned, she has done many things. I would say there are some kind of, you could have some fun if it was revealed that she was a spy with kind of that flip-flop nature of who she deems worthy to be a Mandalorian and how she goes
cool.
from having these huge concrete visions of what Mandalore is and who the Mandalorians are to suddenly being like, well, as many Mandalorians as possible. I mean, okay, so this is, again, on the audacious side, but what if the reason that she's been trying to grow this Mandalorian, you know, group is because she was going to send them to this trap and have Gideon kill them. He says, thank you for bringing all the Mandalorians to one place. You know, so there are arguments, but I agree with you. I think that is someone who does truly care about Mandalore. We know she cares about Beskar and she's very deeply, but then again, she could have been helping Gideon make those uniforms.
That's
he needs
the other
someone
thing.
Who knows how to do it.
That's true, but like
when would she do
how
it?
When would she do it? How would she get there? I guess like the other side of it is that we've noted in past episodes like how effective their recruiting was. This is even before you know, Bo's helmet offs came into the fold.
Yeah.
Like they grew the population of the covert pretty significantly. And so I guess the another way you could go about it, if indeed the armor is a spy, is that she's been assembling this force of Mandalorians to then hand mm-hmm. to Gideon to then become part of his army. Maybe that's it. But it's, again, yeah. I'd find it, it would be audacious, but it would be, I don't know if I could get there. I don't think so, and it would really tear apart everything mm-hmm. that Din and Grogu and so many of those Mandalorians from the covert know about Mandalorian, being a yeah. Mandalorian. Like, it would destroy
them. The ultimate betrayal.
It would be incredible if it was true, but, like, I just can't see it. Maybe Axe, though. Maybe yeah, it is yeah, Axe.
Yeah. A mercenary, I could see that.
Yeah, you could see it being him.
Sure.
All right. I can't wait to talk more about the...
the finale's next week.
The finale of The Mandalorian is going to be a banger. Let me ask you this before we get there. Rick Famuyiwa, who, of course, directed this episode and various great episodes of the Mandalorian television program, has been quoted as saying that the title The Mandalorian no longer refers to just Din. It refers to the Mandalorian people writ large. It's going to be Bo.
Confirmed at Star Wars Celebration. Yeah. It's more about that. Even this season, I think they were saying it's about the Mandalorians as a culture.
Yeah. And I think if you could pull back like the curtain, you might say that some of the kind of like bottle episode segments of this mm-hmm. season, you know, could have been necessary because of like how, you know, maybe they didn't have Pedro as much as they wanted. Are they going to kill Din? Like, Din, Din doesn't show up in any battles going forward. Like any of the big stuff, New Republic versus the First Order.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume he'd be there, although you could come up with any reason that he wouldn't be there. And it has me wondering, that quote from Rick, plus where we are right now in the story, plus the fact that we don't see Din and Grogu running around in any of the big battles. I wonder if he makes it out.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point, especially because we're getting so close to tying this to the sequel trilogy now, and we don't know where Din was. It doesn't look like he was anywhere. So especially when you're starting to do things like Praetorian Guards, you're really directing us towards that First Order. Where would he be? Why wouldn't he be involved? Where is the baby? Maybe they were living off planet somewhere. But I think that it wouldn't be completely out of the realm of possibility that Din does not survive. Probably not this season, but I think I could see a season 4, us saying RIP to Din.
Man, I hope it doesn't happen. I hope it doesn't happen this season. I'm not ready
to say
that about
it. Me too. I mean, let's be real. I want to see him on the big screen. If they're doing this movie, I want to see him with the baby in the mech and Din in his ship. It would be great.
Up next, The Hive Mind with Benny Schwa himself, Ben Schwartz.
Are you spending more time in your basement now that it's your rec room, office, kids' playroom, or home gym? Well, you need to ventilate those spaces to remove stagnant, musty air. For over 20 years, the Easy Breathe ventilation system exchanges dirty, damp air for cleaner, drier, healthier air. Take charge of your indoor air with your own Easy Breathe ventilation system. You can get it installed, or DIY kits are available. Just call 866-822-7328 or visit takechargeofyourair.com and receive 20% off today.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. If tonight's movie night is just what you need, make it special with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Are you spending more time in your basement now that it's your rec room, office, kids' playroom, or home gym? Well, you need to ventilate those spaces to remove stagnant, musty air. For over 20 years, the Easy Breathe ventilation system exchanges dirty, damp air for cleaner, drier, healthier air. Take charge of your indoor air with your own Easy Breathe ventilation system. You can get it installed, or DIY kits are available. Just call 866-822-7328 or visit takechargeofyourair.com and receive 20% off today.
Welcome to The Hive Mind, where we explore a topic in more detail with the help of expert guests. This week, we're absolutely thrilled to have actor and comedian Ben Schwartz. You, of course, know him from Parks and Rec, Sonic the Hedgehog, The After Party on Apple TV+, and the reason for his appearance here, the upcoming film Renfield, out on April 14th, wherever you watch your movies. We watched the movie Renfield, and it's delightful. It's
very
a fun movie.
Very fun.
Here's our conversation with Ben Schwartz. Ben Schwartz, thanks for joining X-Ray Vision.
Jason, did you see the video
yes.
at MSG? Okay, great.
Yeah, I did.
Important topics, important topics.
Should we start there? How are you feeling? What's your gut check feeling about the Knicks in the postseason?
I feel great. By the way, I know people are afraid of Cleveland's defense, of course. It makes total sense.
Yeah.
But I am so excited for a Cleveland matchup. I feel, first of all, ever since we didn't get Donovan, I've been like, every time I see him play and he's had such a good year, I'm
yeah.
like, man, could you imagine if he was on our team? Oh my goodness, can you imagine? And now it's like we literally are matching up with the guy that we almost got. So I am like, I think we have a chance of winning. Like I really feel, I feel strongly.
I'm not saying we're the favorite, but I think we have a chance. I think we
no, we're not the favorite. Amir texted me this morning that we're the we're in the betting pools. We're the low. We're not above. We're the under.
How dare! Never tell us the odds. Ben, Renfield is so fun. What was it like being a villain? Being the bad guy. Being the
heavy. It was crazy. I got to like they put back my hair. They gave me fake tattoos every day. I had tattoos all over my chest and arms. I had to like all the things I've never done in my life: shoot guns, work out. I had to work out for this. race cars, get into fist fights, do a ton of drugs. So it's like I just don't do any of that stuff in real life. So it was so fun. And then I tried to like give the guy mommy issues and like make it so like all
yeah.
this stuff is coming from kind of a pathetic place where he just wants people to like him. And all that stuff was heaven to me. It was really, really fun to take what a villain usually is and kind of blow it up a bit, which was really
mm-hmm.
fun.
Yeah, the whole movie really does that with kind of the idea of like, who is the central force in a story about Dracula? Usually it's Dracula, and obviously here it's Renfield. But what was it like to get to work alongside, obviously, Nicholas is incredible. But then you have Nick Cage, second Nicholas, in like the most Nick Cage role of all time. So what was it like being on set with Nick Cage Dracula?
And by the way, Rosie, I 100% agree. When I watch the movie back and you see what he did as Dracula, it's like incredible. He plays like
yeah,
70 different versions.
Yeah.
It's the most Nick Cage you've ever seen. It's like a, and also I love his performances because he's so unpredictable. Now he has a role where
mm-hmm.
this character is unpredictable too. But it was amazing. And the best part is like in between the Nick Cage stuff, it's like we're shooting a scene where he's like choking me and then throwing me, and then they go, okay, cut, we're gonna switch cameras, and then we sit back at our tables, but he's still dressed as Dracula, of course. And I'm like, I literally said to him, I was like, hey man, so the first time I saw Adaptation, I stopped it, started from the beginning again. I think that movie's unbelievable. I am so in love. And then he's just a great guy who loves movies. He loves
mm-hmm.
movies and has like a pet crow. He's like everything you want Nick Cage to be.
You're of course known for your improv skills, your improv background. How much of that did you bring to bear in this part?
Chris let me go crazy. There's a cut of this movie that's like an hour and change longer than this. And I could literally
cut.
Oh my God. I could point to scenes because I love the movie is 90 minutes long, which makes sense because the movie's gotta like move. It's like a bullet.
Mm-hmm.
It like goes off
yeah.
and you're off to the races. But so they had to lose a lot, but I had so much more. Every scene you've seen me in this film was like a full minute and a half longer, and then they slowly cut it. But like there's a scene where like I have a bag of cocaine in my car and I get into a car accident, and Awkwafina and Adrian Martinez are racing with me, and I throw coke at them. They're cops. And then in that scene, Chris McKay, we shot it for 2 days, let me go into any of the extras' cars and like do like fuck with everybody. And so we were going crazy. And like every scene you see, Chris, we did it as is, and then we did it with me going bananas. Mm. And some of that stuff got in there. And then some of it just like, you know, if I'm going too long, the scene is going too long, then all of a sudden the movie's too long. But so a little bit is in there, but there is like a treasure trove of nonsense somewhere out there on the cutting room floor.
That's for the DVD extras. I don't know. Do they still do those? I still buy DVDs for the streaming extras.
What's the last DVD you bought?
Oh, the last DVD I bought. Well, the place I buy DVDs is the Book Off in Torrance, which sells dollar DVDs. So gorgeous. The last DVDs I bought was a double Mortal Kombat and Mortal Kombat Annihilation box set for $1.
Oh,
I have
an
extensively terrible DVD collection of movies that I love. And one of the things, like, obviously comedy, that's like one of your big loves, one of our big loves here, and one of the reasons we are so stoked to have you on here, this is like a podcast that was born of a love of comics. So can I talk to you a little bit about your love of comics and kind of like, what was your comic book origin? What was the comic that made you fall in love with comics?
I've talked about my I've talked about my Marvel card collection with Jason in the past, but like I started by collecting basketball cards and Marvel cards. And then I started with like, you know, and then my comics start with like Slapstick. I don't know if you remember Slapstick. It was a Marvel movie, but Slapstick.
Oh, of
and
course.
Then like Wolverine, and then X-Men was huge. And then when Superman died was an enormous moment when I was in, you know, there was like the black case that you could buy it in, like the black plastic bag.
Yeah, and the colored triangles, so you knew you were reading the right issues.
Yeah, and like there's, I always loved like the incredible, like there, even like the covers sometimes would get me. Sometimes there'd be a Fantastic Four, like Silver Surfer cover where it was like silver. And like, I would like be so excited to collect like unique things. But anytime there's a first issue of anything, I'm on it just to start it. And in my collecting mind is like, oh my God, this could be worth $1 million also. But I was a huge X-Men fan, huge Wolverine fan, loved Spider-Man because it felt like, I know he wasn't, but like a Jewish kid from the Bronx. I was like a Jewish kid from Riverdale.
No, I think Spider-Man, like there is a large contingent of superhero readers who would say Spider-Man's Jewish.
I'll take that.
I think it's a big one, you know, with the creators who are involved. So I think that's an ongoing conversation.
You know what I also did? I also did Ren and Stimpy. I did everything. My comic shop was called Alternate Realities. It's on Central Avenue in Westchester. Mm. And I would just go there, collect basketball, Marvel cards, and collect comics, and then play the Jurassic Park pinball machine. It was like it's what I would do after high school. It was the best.
Speaking of that, you have been outspoken in your desire to see a Plastic Man movie. You have a pitch.
Jason, I've been so screwed. This tour, this press tour, I feel like James Gunn is going to hate me.
No, I have to say, this is partially my fault because in 2021, me and you chatted about Flora and Ulysses. And because it was for Nerdist and it was about comics, I was like, what comic book characters would you like to play? And we ran a piece about how you had a Plastic Man pitch. And every time I see that story come up now, I'm like, I'm sorry, man.
It is by far the superhero I want to be more than anything else. But I feel like it almost feels like the guy that like wears like the band's t-shirt for the band. Like I feel so bad because I'm like so passionate about it. And I even pitched a Plastic Man idea to that studio a very long time ago. Mm-hmm. And like, I have so many ideas for what it is, but I feel like sorry to interrupt you, Jason. I like love that character, but ask your question knowing now that I'm like so worried that every time this comes up, James is going to be like, this guy won't shut up about, but go. I want to answer your question then we'll do it.
All right. Well, what is it? I guess, what is it about Plastic Man that resonates with you?
So when I watched Deadpool for the Marvel Universe, I thought Plastic Man could be that for the DC Universe. And what I think is fun is that Plastic Man is a thief. Eli O'Brien is a thief, right? He even gets his superpowers while he's, you know, around his, you know, bad guys, whatever. And they ditch him, which is also in the original one, which is also something interesting to think of. That even that group of people who are assholes don't like him. But I thought the fun of this character would be he gets powers, but he doesn't stop being a thief. And the course of the movie is people, like, he has to finally be convinced to use his powers for good. But I think he's so funny. And even in the cartoon versions, he's funny. And then if you look at the new comics that Gail did, like, there's so much comedy in there. And I think your article then brought out Gail, who was a writer for Plastic Man. And she had said that she based some of the character off of me and, like, Parks and stuff like that. Or something like that. So it's like, it's also like, I don't look too, I can kind of look like him too. I can look like Neil too. So it's like, I can never be Thor. I can never be like, so it's like, I can play the skinny guy that stretches pretty good. So just the idea of it being funny, the idea of it being like almost meta, because he kind of breaks mm-hmm. he does all that stuff. And also just, you know, it feels like the mask almost a little bit too, like that Jim Carrey flavor of like, I can really improvise and really go bananas in this type of movie and turn it special and funny. But I love the idea of a thief getting powers, and it takes a whole film for him to be convinced to use them for good.
Yeah, I mean, Plastic Man is some of the most exciting kind of transgressive stories. Gail Simone's obviously incredible. Kyle Baker's Plastic Man is like one of my favorite cartooning exhibits of all time. Do you have a dream? Like, who would play your Woozy Winks? Who would be like your hapless sidekick?
Well, what's the exact ethnicity of Woozy and that stays constant? Do we know? Is it a specific thing? Is it?
No, you can pick Woozy... whoever you want. It's 2023. I think he's usually just a little white dude, but you can just pick whoever you want.
I don't think he's white. I think Woozy's not white, right? Is Woozy going to be the first Filipino Eugene Cordero character introduced?
Well, there we are. Now you're talking. This is what I'm saying.
I think Bobby would be amazing. I don't know the ethnicity of Woozy because I know it's a little different, but Bobby up Moynihan would be amazing. Eugene would be amazing. There's a lot of different people that can play that role, but I would love somebody that I can bounce off of, and we could find fun, gorgeous things. But and also the idea that I think that Plastic Man essentially becomes a part of the Justice League. So it's like that character is so insane in that world of like Superman and like all these like very straight laced characters that it would just be heaven for a comedian to play that type of role.
Speaking of Eugene Cordero, he is jacked, absolutely ripped. You mentioned that just busting out of his shirt. Every time I see him, the guy is getting bigger and bigger, bigger. And you mentioned that, you had to get in the Iron Church and start praying to the weights for this role. Can you describe the workout regimen for Renfield?
Yes, it was very small. I had to be strong enough to hold two guns this way. I cut down a little weight, and then I turned a little into thing. And by the way, I needed it because to do these stunts, you do them over and over again. Mm. And like I play basketball, but you know, it's like I don't have like my muscle strength is not where it should be. And no joke, the first couple days of doing tests with these guns, they were like these gold guns, almost reminiscent of like Face Off, like Castor Troy guns. Yeah. And I have a scene where I stick up Awkwafina and I put the gun near her head and I hold it for like a good minute and a half while I do this monologue. The monologue's been cut down quite a bit, but it's like, so the first like take where you're like, when I was like doing screen test stuff, I saw my hand like going like this because I just wasn't strong enough to hold these guns for that long. So my workout regimen was the Chris Brewster, who is the stunt guy, gave me like some workout stuff, and it was mostly like it wasn't like crazy stuff. It was like me getting in the hotel gym, me working out with free weights, me getting on some just whatever and working out, and it gave me enough to be able to do it, which was really exciting. And then it was so funny, the second I wrapped the fight scenes, I was in New Orleans, I slowly gained weight for the rest of the movie. Like you'll see my character like slowly gets bigger and bigger. The second I was done with all the parts that had to do with whatever, it was just, I just kept eating and eating in that city. It's so hard not to, it's so hard to eat healthy in that city.
Yeah, too much delicious food. So with this, you kind of touched on it, but kind of this idea of like turning the idea of what a villain is and exploding it. How do you balance those moments? Like that moment in the club with Awkwafina that's in the trailer where you have that monologue, you still have to be menacing. How do you bring that balance of kind of unhinged scariness with all the comedy and kind of pathetic aspects that you're bringing to the character?
That's a great question. It was something that Chris McKay, who's the director, and I really thought about. That moment especially was a big one. Even when I auditioned, he's like, I want to see, in my head, I'd never killed somebody before. My character had never actually killed somebody. He's all talk. His whole thing is talking. Mm-hmm. He's just trying to impress his mom and his friends. So he has the gun to Awkwafina's face, and then she says, do it. Shoot me. I don't think you'll do it. And like you see my gears start turning, like, oh my God, am I going to have to actually do this? And we spent a bunch of time being like, how do we make this look real and watch this person flip from being this person who just talks to actually someone who's going to pull the trigger? And so like we shot that scene for days and had such great like dramatic moments. So for me to, there's a bunch of that scene that got cut where like I'm like doing bits with all the people, like I'm like intimidating everybody when I get in there. and then I finally get to her and have this really dramatic moment. That was exactly what you said, where I'm juggling this big comedy and then, okay, now this moment I have to be like serious. And now this moment mm-hmm. I have to be terrified that I'm going to take somebody's mm-hmm. life. And we really played with that. We really tried to find those moments and try to make them real. So you feel the character whenever they switch, like when I'm unhinged and on drugs and then really zoned in and like, oh my God, what am I going to do? It was really a fun part of the whole process.
The action scenes are spectacular. Each one of them has its own particular hook, which I really liked. You know, there's a strong Jackie Chan element here, and then the end yeah. fight is really exciting. Tell us about doing fight scenes.
It's, you know, it's so funny. So I did a show called The After Party right before this, and it was yeah. My episode was a musical episode. So I had to learn how to do choreography and sing and dance and everything. And I couldn't believe how strong the dancers were and how incredible they were. And they were like all superstars, and regardless of genders or anything, they were like superheroes to me. And mm-hmm. I had to learn how to do that. And so I went from that to this, and there's a lot of similarities. Like to learn choreography, it was the first time that I had to learn like real, like, you know, me and Nick Holt for weeks beforehand would go through our fights and, you know, do make sure we're not hurting each other and da da da. And it was really fun. And then I gained so much respect for the stunt team. I spent so much of my time, my off time with that stunt team and Marvin Ross and all those guys. And so it's like, it's incredible. And it's all a dance. It's all like, if you're rhythmic and can do it, that so like my stuff from the After Party really helped me for my stunt stuff here. But when I first started fighting, I would do like every kid, I would go like, and like the director had to tell me to stop making the noises. Like, yeah. we'll do that in post. You don't have to do the, yeah. because never in my life have I like play fighter with someone and not pretend to like doosh, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was very funny to get that note from the stunt director and the stunt guys being like, Ben, you don't stop moving your mouth when you're, I was like, okay, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, Michelle Yeoh, she was actually a dancer before she became a martial artist, before she was in the Sammo movies.
She is so inspiringly incredible.
The icon.
Yeah.
The unbelievable.
It's insane.
Were there any action movies or particular fight scenes or anything that people directed you to or that you revisited as you were prepping for this? Because it is like, it's an action movie. And I think a lot of people won't yeah. know that till they go and see it in the theater.
And also the action is like superhero action. We're like, you know, mm-hmm. we get superpowers and I'm on wires and being thrown all over the place and being flung in the air and stuff.
People's limbs are getting torn off and...
yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the best. Being used as nunchucks. I didn't watch it for the action stuff. I do love my John Wick series. I haven't seen the fourth mm-hmm. one, but I do love a John Wick movie. But I grew up, me and my dad watched, you know, every action movie in the universe we watched together. So nothing that prepared. The movies that I watched prepare for the role were Goodfellas, Donnie Brasco, Mean Streets. Mm. And then I thought my character had those posters on his wall, but my character could never be those guys. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like
yeah.
he had those posters on his wall and he wants to be like them, but he could never, mm-hmm. he just doesn't have it in him to be it. So that's kind of those things. He aspired to be those guys.
What I love about this movie is that it is, first of all, it's fast paced, as you mentioned.
Yes.
The action scenes are wonderful. It has a story. We were talking about this in the group chat earlier. I legitimately cannot remember the last movie that dealt with a man in an abusive relationship before. Which is a thing that is under talked about. And I can't remember the last movie that dealt with this. This deals with it in a really fun and cathartic way. And it's really funny. How much of that was evident when you were pitched this project, when you started going out?
The script was amazing. Ryan Ridley, Robert Kirkman, who did The Walking Dead, and by the way, yep. Invincible, if you guys love comics.
Yeah, iconic comic book yeah. creator.
Oh my God. And the TV show is just unbelievably yeah. good. But he thought of the idea of Kirkman, then he gave it to Ryan Ridley, who wrote for the first bunch of seasons of Rick and Morty. The script was amazing. And the script had all that stuff in there. And it also is kind of like inspiring for someone who wants to get out of a toxic relationship, someone who mm-hmm. feels like their boss at work is like they can't get out of their job and they just don't have they don't have the confidence in themselves to break free because, you know, the negative and the failure is so scary. So all that stuff was evident in there. But the script was, the reason why I wanted to do it was I never got to play a villain before in my life. I've never gotten to do these fight scenes. I remember talking to my agent because I, at the time when, after I auditioned, I got lucky and I had two offers at the same time and I had to choose what to do, this or something else. And my agent's like, you're always going to be able to play this Nebushi Jewish character. You're very rarely going to be able to play this villain of a studio film, Ben. And I was like, you're right, you're right, you're right. And it was just so clear that it's like, I had so much fun doing it for the reasons why I never get to play those characters. But all that stuff was definitely evident in there. And I think it's what makes movies good. You know, when you have something to bite onto for any of your characters, that's when it's like the most exciting. If you're just seeing fight scene, fight scene, fight scene, it's, you're going to get bored. But if, you know, even when we're watching Marvel movies or DC movies, if it's just a series of set pieces with nothing in between, you don't care about what happens. Mm-hmm. But if you make you care about the characters and you see that Nick Holt is trying to break free and you see that Dracula's kind of petty also, that's like, you're getting invested in all of it. So I think it's so necessary. And I think Ryan really crushed it. The script, the original version of the script that I read was one of the better scripts I'd read in a long time.
Mm. No. Yeah, that really comes through. It's so funny. It's surprisingly sweet while also featuring people being like lambasted with, you know, broken limbs. So the other thing I think is really cool about this, even though, you know, it's not necessarily being presented this way, this is essentially like a universal monster movie. And we haven't had one of those for a while. The last one we had was Lee Wan on Invisible Man, which is like such a different movie. Unbelievable.
I thought they crushed that movie.
So good. I remember abusive relationship.
I remember watching that movie and there was a scene where it was just a blank. It was like a scene where the director was like kind of like filming near the ceiling or something like that. And there's nothing on camera. And I remember being terrified. And I wrote down in a notebook how I couldn't believe how literally nothing, like you think of that day, they literally just put a camera there and press record. And the weight of that scene was so scary to me and so intense. I was really inspired by that. I wrote in a notepad, like, remember this. Remember that you can cause drama just by, like, you don't need things happening all the time. I thought that was really beautifully done, that movie. Sorry, but yes, you said that.
Nothing but suggestion. It's so powerful. Well, I was just going to say, what's it like to then get to create a character, to get this brilliant script that's in this iconic world that goes back, you know, 100 years, that has people like Bela Lugosi, like pure icons, Boris Karloff, and then to get to create a new character in there and be alongside Dracula, one of the most iconic, you know, monsters, movie monsters of all time.
It's when I have my scenes with Dracula and when he, like, I don't even know if it's in the movie, but like when he like comes after me and stuff like that, it's like it's so exciting. It's so exciting because you know about where they shot these movies. You know how long ago they shot these movies. You know Bram Stoker. You know all these things. You know Leslie Nielsen. So it's like to be a part of the legacy and then to create something new that could essentially now is like a canon, as we say in our nerdy words. So it's like that is like, It's so exciting. And then technically, no matter what happens to my character, this character now exists in the universe of all these other
the
things.
Joy.
Yeah. And it's a brand new character, which is like, you know, so it's very, very exciting. It's for someone who really respects this stuff, I'm very excited.
Okay. Final question. It's a little bit of a nuts and bolts question for me. Does the size of the bug matter? Because Renfield's eating like little spiders and some ants and stuff. And at the end, you snort like a centipede that's like 8 inches long.
Huge.
And I would imagine that the bigger the bug, the bigger the powers. Perceive that? Yeah. What did you think about that?
This is a great question. I only ate one bug. He eats a series of different bugs. Now, is it the heart? Is it the blood from the bug? Is it, what is it? What is it that's really fueling him? We don't really know. But I love that. It's like my character starts. Oh my God. In that scene, they cut the beginning of that scene. But that scene, my very first scene where you see me in the car and I do coke. It was a whole scene before that where I'm talking to my daughter and putting her to sleep while I'm doing coke and doing this job. That's how my character's like entrance was in this. And we did I improvised forever on that. But I love that my character's mirrored that the first time you see him, he snorts coke. And then when he gets to be this superpowered guy, he snorts the millipede in the same way. I would say that the bigger the bug, The more mass, the better. That's why he's constantly eating bugs.
Exactly. So it grows. The power grows.
I figure out like spinach. If Popeye ate half a can of spinach, would he be half as strong or would he still be as strong? Does he have to pop the whole thing out?
Right.
Important questions.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Well, listen, go see Renfield April 14th.
Yeah, go see Renfield. It's total joy. And James Gunn, make that Plastic Man movie.
Ben Schwartz, thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us. Go Knicks.
Oh my God, go Knicks. Absolutely go Knicks, everybody.
Thank you to Ben Schwartz for appearing. Up next, Nerd Out.
In today's Nerd Out, where you tell us what you love and why, or a theory that you're excited to share, Mike posits the latter, a theory, about the inspiration behind Mandalorian Chapter 22, Guns for Hire. And this is very unique. I had not heard this theory before, but it makes a lot of sense. Jason, I'll allow you to do the honors.
Sure. Jason and Rosie. The entire setting of Plazier 15 reeked of the show making fun of Disney World and Disneyland. The domes are very Epcot-esque. That is true. The monorail, all of the people focusing on leisure and not working, Dinbo being presented with a ceremonial key to the city, and Grogu getting knighted at the end, et cetera, et cetera. All of this seemed like a play on the over-the-top experiences that people can have at a Disney park, which Mike professes to be a very ardent admirer of the magic of Disney parks. And this is... I think this is pretty interesting, actually.
Yeah.
Like the way the monorail speaks and everything, too. I hadn't
put this together. Yeah, I hadn't considered it, but it's really interesting, especially like Mike, he points out this could be kind of like a satire. It's not like some cruel mockery, but it's kind of a satire.
It's not like mocking it.
Fun of Disneyland and kind of
I mean, certainly everybody who is staying on Plazier 15, who is in a droid, is absolutely loving life.
This would also make a lot of sense because it's kind of a nice, fun rebuttal slash knowing wink to how much the Star Wars TV shows have actually been about promoting the Disneyland park. You know, the really fun Star Wars Disneyland park that they built. There's been a lot of direct tie-ins in the Star Wars shows to that new location. So it's kind of fun to imagine that this is them sort of going... nod, nod, wink, wink, like maybe Disneyland's kind of an evil, like, leisure planet. Like, it's a lot of fun. I love this reading.
I'm running with this. And the fact that, like, I've not heard this before. So, first of all, Mike, kudos for a really, really original
and insightful take.
It's
so unique. I had not seen anyone do this read. It's so fun.
And it leads me to believe that if this indeed is the subtext, right? I bet you no one caught it on the way out. Like part of the reason why I think this would have gotten through is like nobody caught it. And of course, it also does portray, like if indeed it is a metaphor for Disneyland, Disney World, it portrays it in largely a really, really great light. I mean, like everybody's just like living and shopping and eating well without a care in the world, all of their, you know, needs taken care of by various droid servants. Like, it's fun.
I kind of like, Mike also makes the point that, like, he's not 100% sure where the resistor bar stands in that. But there is also an argument for the idea that for you to have fun at Disneyland, a ton of people have to work jobs that you don't have to do so you can enjoy it. And I think that's also kind of an interesting aspect of it. The droid aspect's also fun because the nature of Disney is there's all these kind of almost like Five Nights at Freddy's folklore about the animatronics and the kind of spookiness of Disney parks. And I like that that leans into it. I just think this is such a cool, fun read. And I mean, all of this stuff constantly feeds off each other. The parks, the movies, the comics, the TV shows, the storytelling, the creators who are involved in it. So it makes a lot of sense that they could be having fun. I mean, even when you think about it, even the way that like Lizzo and Jack Black are dressed really feels like it sells into this. Lizzo's kind of this Disney princess in deep space.
One more wrinkle to add to this that supports Mike's theory. Disneyland, Disney World, is a noted hirer of many older and retired cast members who then work at the parks to augment their their fixed income. And that is absolutely in line with the droids who are concerned about, like,
that they're going to be replaced.
Older models here, and we don't want to be replaced. Like, we still want to be useful. So there, that's another little piece that I think supports Mike's assertion. This is very, very interesting. Mike, man, thank you so much.
That was such a great theory.
That was a great one. If you have theories or passions you want to share, hit us up at xray@crooked.com. Instructions are in the show notes. Okay, that's it for us. Big thank you to Ben Schwartz. Rosie, any plugs? Plugs.
You can find me, Rosie Marks, at Instagram and Letterboxd. I have a Substack that I'm running that's going to have some really cool interviews coming up soon. Recommend you all kinds of books and comics because I get loads of great messages of people messaging me and saying, hey, what should I read? What should I do? There is a wonderful graphic novel that I read that I will recommend to you now. That's called The Moth Keeper by Kay O'Neill. It's absolutely delightful, just totally magical. I think all of our fans who love Lord of the Rings and fantasy and big, beautiful artistic stories will absolutely find a lot of joy in it. So check that one out. And then obviously here, twice a week, talking about cool stuff.
Of course, for me, Primo on Amazon Freebie. May 19th, watch Primo on Amazon Freebie. How much do I need to subscribe? It's free.
It's free.
It's right there in the name.
It's
free. It's like old school television. There's going to be commercial breaks and everything. Amazon Freebie, May 19th. Primo, the Primo television program. Catch our next episode of the X-Ray Vision podcast program on Wednesday, April 19th for more market moves on Succession and more creepiness with the Yellow Jackets.
In case you've somehow forgotten from when I just said it 2 seconds ago, let us remind you that we are bringing you 2 episodes a week, not one, but 2. And you can not only listen to them, you can also watch them on YouTube, where we post full episodes. So make sure you subscribe there. Also follow us at XRVPod on Twitter, where we're always retweeting cool stuff, sharing funny moments from the show and all kinds of rad things. And check out the Discord, hang out with a bunch of cool, awesome X-Ray Vision listeners who love all kinds of rad stuff and are always talking about things even outside of the galaxy of what we talk about with X-Ray Vision. And me and Jason are there saying funny stuff too.
5-star ratings, 5-star reviews.
Five.
We need them. We got to have them. You got to give them to us. Here's one from Crystal M.D.E. King. I'm with you till the end of the line, X-Ray Vision. What a joy it is to get to listen to Jason and Rosie talk about my favorite things in life, not once, but twice a week. Their discussions and deep dives are so helpful, and I feel like I'm part of the conversation. Anytime I've reached out with a question or follow-up, Rosie has been so generous with her knowledge and expertise. Thank you for being my go-to and favorite podcast. Thank you, Crystal.
Oh, thank you.
That's so wonderful. X-Ray Vision is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Chris Lord and Saul Rubin. The show is executive produced by myself and Sandy Gerard. Our editing and sound design is by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Dylan Villanueva and Matt DeGroote provide video production support. Alex Relaford handles social media. Thank you, Brian Vasquez, for our theme music. That's it for us. See you next time. Hey, Mike, this is Islam from Marine. Yeah, I want to talk about Thrawn today. I don't know if you know this about me, Mike, but part of the reason why I'm able to call so much is I got laid off. I got laid off from my Imperial pipe fitting job. They just laid me off, no warning at all, no benefits, nothing. I'm just out on my ass listening to the radio all the time. But I want to say one thing about the hypocrisy here, Mike, because Grand Admiral Thrawn, where is he? Where is this guy? No one knows. And yet, no one's talking about coming for his job. Apparently, people are still willing to follow him into the next war or whatever is going on. They're still paying his salary. I get laid off. No one says anything to me. I don't hear anything. I don't hear from anybody. Grand Admiral Thrawn disappears for months and years at a time. Nobody knows where this guy is. And they're still willing to follow him and still willing to hold his job for him. Where is he, Mike? I'll take my ass off the air, thanks.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Tenor girl go shopping.
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you spending more time in your basement now that it's your rec room, office, kids' playroom, or home gym? Well, you need to ventilate those spaces to remove stagnant, musty air. For over 20 years, the Easy Breathe ventilation system exchanges dirty, damp air for cleaner, drier, healthier air. Take charge of your indoor air with your own Easy Breathe ventilation system. You can get it installed, or DIY kits are available. Just call 866-822-7328 or visit takechargeofyourair.com and receive 20% off today.
You.